Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, follow the Pope on Twitter for Lent. Hear about this innovative idea from the Vatican's Council for Social Communications. Discover why Methodists are in the middle of the ecumenical movement. And I'll be talking to the founder and director of the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health, seeking to promote a more compassionate face for healthcare in the United States. Some people like to give up a favourite food for Lent. Others choose to follow a Bible study course or commit to helping those less fortunate than themselves. But in our increasingly secular societies, many young people no longer keep the Lenten season in any special way at all. That's why the Pontifical Council for Social Communications has come up with a new idea to focus hearts and minds on the challenges contained in Pope Benedict's Lenten message for 2012. Starting on Ash Wednesday, themes from that papal message will be posted on Twitter each day during Lent. And over the coming months, many other papal speeches and documents are likely to be tweeted in a similar way, hoping to attract the media-savvy generation and entice them to find out more. But is it all just another technological gimmick that dumbs down the message of the Church? Not at all, says Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. Many of the key gospel ideas, he says, are readily rendered in just 144 characters.
The idea was to use a channel that we've established for some time, a website called popetoyou.net, which obviously has a Twitter capacity, which we've been using on various occasions. But the idea was, very simply, to try and use Twitter to share with people the essence of the Pope's message for Lent. So the idea is, over the 40 days of Lent, to tweet every day one of the phrases, one of the ideas, one of the central sentences of this message. It's a very simple little gesture, but it allows people to receive every day a little thought for the day, if we want to call it that, a little point that might help them to reflect or cause them to help them to think their way through Lent. So it follows a little bit from the message of World Communications this year, which is talking about the importance of silence, and silence being the place where we can have time to reflect. And in that message for World Communications Day, the Pope had talked about how you can use small messages as short as a gospel passage to communicate important truths. So responding to that, we thought it'd be interesting to take the message, find 40 key ideas and share them over the time, and allowing people maybe that time to reflect or to think or to be impacted on during their busy schedule by something that comes as easily as into their handheld device. And the other thing we kind of then began to work on is we were interested in seeing this as Pope to You as the central point for sharing it, but not trying to tie people into that, but doing it in a way that people can retweet. And already we've seen a network of people we know from our meeting with bloggers last year, people we know who follow our work and follow our, are already retweeting with this idea. So that the popetoyou.net site, we know that we have on our Twitter channel, we have something like 2,700 followers. But more importantly, we have the possibility to reach out to others through those who retweet. So it's an experiment also for us to see how it goes, see what level of impact it has. It's something dynamic and different.
It's an experiment, you're saying, but it's true to say that the Pope to You site has had a certain amount of success already.
The Pope to You site had phenomenal success at the time of its launch, when it was one of our earliest ventures into new media, and we had this phenomenal effect of having over 5 million hits in the first week or two of its operation. Since that, we decided, and the site was actually established just to do that job and then probably to close down, but the level of interest was such, we decided we should keep it going. And we kept it going by focusing on the big themes in the life of the Church, so the Christmas, Easter, World Youth Day, and times like that, when we use the site in a way that allows us to continue to reach out to these loyal followers we have, people who are interested in the site.
I understand from Archbishop Celli that fairly soon we will also be able to get the Pope's Angelus and some other interesting speeches and things on Twitter as well.
Yes, I think a lot of attention has been given to the idea of seeing Twitter as a channel that could allow for a more direct and immediate way of sharing the nucleus of the Pope's thoughts on various occasions. So I don't think it'll be confined to Lent. I think we'll be looking at the possibility of Twitter being used directly for texts approved by the Pope to bring them forward in the future.
Now, Twitter, of course, 140 characters. There will be the critics who say this is dumbing down the Pope's message.
To those who say it's dumbing down the Pope's message, is one is to see this is entry level. This is to allow a certain condensation of the thought to hit people, impact on people, and to provoke their interest and to invite them then to follow the full of the message, to read the full of the text. But to those who say, you know, it's a dumbing down, it's not. I mean, many of the key gospel ideas are readily rendered in 144 characters. So I think it would be a shame to say this is not the only way the Pope will speak, this is not the only way the Church speaks, but it's an avenue that is open to us and that we have to learn to use. And I think it's one pithy, succinct rendering of our message is something we're actually quite good at.
And it'll be available, if I understand, in half a dozen languages?
Yeah, the idea is that this is available now in the principal languages which we work here, Spanish, Italian, French, German, English, of course, and we have Portuguese just about to come.
So
www.popetoyou.net for the starting point.
My thanks to Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. Methodists in the Middle was the title of a talk given recently at the International Catholic Caravita community here in Rome by a specialist in ecumenism with the World Methodist Council. Professor Robert Gribben is a noted theologian and liturgist, as well as a minister of the Uniting Church in Australia. He currently serves as the chair of the Ecumenics and Dialogue Standing Committee of the World Methodist Council. I caught up with him during his visit to Rome to find out more about his presentation and about his hopes for the ecumenical movement. You talk about Methodists in the Middle. What exactly do you mean by that, first of all?
Well, I was looking at the list of churches with whom the Methodist Church has a dialogue, with the Catholic Church at one end and the Salvation Army Church at the other, and the Anglicans just between us. And it seemed to me that in our dialogues, the Methodists were speaking, as it were, to the right and to the left, and to churches from whom we were formed, namely the Church of England, and churches who left us to form themselves, namely the Salvation Army.
The Anglican Communion, of course, itself sees a role as the via media, doesn't it? It tends to see itself as between the left and the right, if you want to use those terms.
It has traditionally. I'm not sure how true that now is, because I think from an English perspective that is true, because the significance of the Church of England is very large, both for other Anglicans in the world and for other churches in England. And the link, because of its reformed episcopacy, is obviously a useful one to work on theologically. But I'm not sure when you look, say, in, again, Australia, where the Presbyterian tradition, the Methodist tradition, are really almost as strong as the Anglican, that you would see them as a particular kind of bridge.
Certainly the Methodist dialogues, and particularly the Methodist dialogue with the Catholic world, seem to be incredibly successful, though perhaps under the radar, as they're sometimes called.
Yes, I'm sure it is far too far under the radar. It is our oldest dialogue, and of course dialogue between churches really began after the Second Vatican Council. So it was the Catholic Church that really set the pattern from which all other dialogues, I think, have derived their method. It has been a very successful one. It has been at the highest theological level, very distinguished members on both sides serving on the teams, and every 5 years on the dot producing a substantial report.
Why do you think this is the case? Why is it so successful? What is the secret, do you think?
The secret, I think, is really the dedication to pursuing difficult questions until they can be reframed or resolved. And as I say, on both sides, there has been serious scholarship applied to that task. The interesting move in the recent years, I've just been reviewing the 40 years of our dialogue, and it began very tentatively because we'd never done it before. And so all sorts of questions, moral issues and theological issues and liturgical issues came up first and were revisited. But slowly the focus came in on central theological matters like, how do we understand the Church? How do we understand the authority of the Church? How do we understand the sources of our theology and doctrine? And then questions of ministry. And then marriage, family life, prayer, spirituality, and so on. But there's been a move clearly now to harvest the fruits, as Cardinal Casper put it, to harvest the fruits and to turn in a much more practical direction and getting above the radar, perhaps, now saying, what would it be like for two congregations, a Catholic congregation and a Methodist congregation in a local neighbourhood, to begin to talk to each other on the basis of what has been agreed?
There are those who say that this emphasis, perhaps, on the practical working together is a result of lack of any real progress now on the theological questions, the so-called ecumenical winter, if you like, on the theological level. What's your view on that?
Yes, I don't think it's a substitute or a new form of the dialogue to go practical and local. I hope it was always intended that that is where it would finally bear fruit. I'm not quite sure about the ecumenical winter either, but I do think there's a cultural move. But let me come back to the other question. We are at a time when most of the smaller theological issues have been well dealt with. And we've come to a point of understanding each other, which means that well-inherited prejudices have been laid to rest, at least for the church leaderships. And that means that we can now talk to local congregations and saying, you know, the Methodists can go and sit down and pray with the Catholic Church and nobody will eat you. I'm reminded of a story early in the ecumenical movement in Melbourne when, for the first time, Anglicans and Catholics began to meet. This is probably about 40 years ago. And the two archbishops of Melbourne came together at the Anglican Bishop's Court. And at the end of a marvellously fruitful day, the Anglican Archbishop said, well, I think perhaps we can pray the Our Father together. And everybody said, well, that would be a lovely idea. And so they started off in the common text, of course. And towards the end, the Anglicans knew that the Catholics didn't add the doxology at the end. So they stopped, and all the Catholics carried on. Slowly we learned to pray together.
You talked about the high level of scholarship over the past 40 years. There's also a great concern today about a lack of new, enthusiastic ecumenists coming up through the ranks. Is that true for the Methodist Church?
I don't think it is. I mean, part of my job is to fill the teams for the diverse dialogues that we now have. And there are younger men and women who have the scholarship. I have to say that I think that the United States seminaries still produce scholars of a very high order, and also Britain and non-English speaking Europe, if I can call them that. So there's not any difficulty fulfilling the lists. Now, in one sense, that's a tiny number of people, but the strength is there.
One of the key areas, of course, of difference, you mentioned authority, and in particular this question of the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, a question that all the dialogues are struggling with. Where do you think the Methodist Council stands on that at the moment?
It has not been a particular topic in any of our dialogues. I think that we have we've started with the grand common inheritance of the Holy Trinity, the nature of Jesus Christ, the Church, and the other things that I mentioned. For instance, the position of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the two churches' spirituality has only just been gently touched on. So the primacy question, I think, remains to be spoken about at any length. It is there because it is the source of authority within the Catholic Church. I think, I'm thinking of one particular report, it can at least be envisaged by Methodists that some kind of universal source of authority in the Church, that it could at least be envisaged. And we have not said no, we simply cannot talk about that possibility. As you say, other churches are struggling with it. I wouldn't have thought that it was particularly a struggle, because I don't think we've really engaged with it yet. Orthodox Catholic dialogue is probably the one that has come closest to it. The Anglican dialogue has had a substantial report on it. But we come to the point where we have to separate the issues we discuss into three categories. One, the things which we now understand we completely agree on. The second, those things on which there's been clearly a movement or convergence. And there may be things yet to be talked about, but we're well on the way. And the third are the hard basket. And the hard basket has not been put away. It's just waiting for us to get to it.
Your speciality, or one of your specialities, is also the questions of liturgy.
Yes.
And Eucharistic liturgy,
yes,
in particular, isn't it? That presumably,
yes,
is in the hard basket.
My great love, yes. I don't think the liturgy is in the hard basket. What aspect do you mean?
Thinking of the question, the focus on the Eucharist and the
role...
You
mean receiving the Eucharist between
the, Eucharist,
the churches.
Yes.
Yes, that is hard. That is actually deeply painful. Because the love of word and sacrament is actually universal in the Christian Church. And when people who are deeply dedicated to those means of grace find themselves together in ecumenical prayer, and then some cannot receive the bread and the wine, that is painful. And that is one of the things that I think we've been continually returning to. And with the Ecumenical Directory of the Catholic Church, a number of steps were taken forward where there were situations when it was right for us to stand together. But the division is still between seeing the Eucharist as a goal to which we move, and when we understand each other in the faith, we can move, and those who see that the Eucharist is the very sacramental grace which leads us together into union with Christ. And I happen to vote for the second, and the Catholic Church happens to vote for the first.
What ways do you think we can still explore to try and move faster on this, as you say, critical area?
At a number of levels, I think. I am, of course, an enthusiast for the teaching of liturgical theology in theological seminaries and colleges. It's often a bit of a widow, the liturgical aspect. But the more seminarians and students understand the depths of the Eucharist, the more they can recognize genuine Eucharist in the other side. I told the story the other night that one of the exercises I put before early students is to place before them four or five texts of Eucharistic prayers, the prayers over the bread and wine, without labelling them, and I ask them to tell me which church they belong to. Now, it's not a nasty trick on my professorial part, because you can identify them, but you have to look hard. We have all drawn on common scholarship, and that common scholarship, I think, has produced a liturgical revolution, but it still stops short of the theological issue of when is it right for us to receive the Eucharist at each other's hands at one table.
What makes you most hopeful at the moment?
Well, I think the movement is slow. That's a frustration. One would always like to see these things happen, for instance, in one's own lifetime. I think some of these things most certainly will not happen in mine. I think it's the constant discovery of a fellow Christian in a community that you wouldn't quite have expected to find such a deep connection. And in the ecumenical movement, friends are made who's getting to know each other changes their attitude to themselves, to their neighbours and to the churches. And in that encounter, there is hope.
My thanks there to Reverend Professor Robert Gribbin, Chair of the Ecumenics and Dialogue Standing Committee of the World Methodist Council. The George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health was set up in 2001 with an ambitious goal: to change the face of the healthcare system in the United States by promoting a more compassionate and integrated type of care. Through education and innovative programs, publications and conferences, it's done just that and has had a major impact on hospitals and healthcare professionals across the US and beyond. At the heart of its mission is the belief that spirituality, understood in its broadest sense, has a profound effect on our health and well-being, as well as helping us to deal with sickness, suffering and death. The founder and director of the Institute, Dr. Christina Puchalski, came to our studios with Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Caritas Confederation. Christina, tell me about this George Washington Institute. It was founded over a decade ago.
But the work for it started over 20 years ago. And it started with a course I developed at George Washington University on spirituality and health. And the impetus for that was some work that I did at NIHS when I was a researcher, and noticing how people who were coming to the National Institutes for Health for treatment because conventional treatment had failed, and while they were thought of as sort of end-stage hopeless cases, in my experience with them, they had tremendous amount of resources from spirituality, faith, that impacted and their lives. And I felt that that was important for clinicians to recognize.
So the aim was to develop this area of work and spread.
Exactly. And around that time, there were others who were beginning to do some research on the role of religion, spirituality, and health. My focus initially was developing courses so the doctors would learn how to address spiritual issues with patients. And then over the years, we had the first course was in 1992, and now we have about 75% of medical schools in the United States that have topics related to spirituality and health integrated in their curricula.
So it's been hugely successful, in fact.
I think so, yeah. And we actually have a textbook, the first textbook in spirituality and health coming out, which is edited by Mark Cobb, who is in the United Kingdom. He's in England. Myself from the U.S. and Bruce Rumbold from Australia. And we have contributors from all over the world. And this will be coming out with Oxford University Press in the spring of this year.
I imagine there must be critics, though, people who say that this really question of faith and spirituality has nothing to do with, quote, serious medicine.
Yes, that's true. There are critics, though. It's changing, but there are critics, and some of the concerns may be even valid. And the concerns are, is it appropriate for doctors and nurses to talk about spirituality with their patients? Shouldn't this just be left in the realm of the chaplains, for example? Or there's a concern about proselytizing. But I think one of our aims at the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health is to make this accessible to all people so that issues of meaning and purpose and how people cope with suffering and their understanding of their illness outside of themselves in a broader philosophical context transcends religion and transcends cultures, really about meaning and purpose. One of our definitions that we developed by consensus in a consensus conference was that spirituality has to do with how people find meaning and purpose in their life and how they express it, but also their connection with the other. And that other may be sacred or significant. It may be God. It may be people. It may be community. It may be nature. It may be the arts. So in fact, the critics, once they understand that definition, realize that it is something at a broader level that is relevant to people's lives. And we have ethical standards. You know, it's inappropriate for doctors and nurses to do what chaplains do because we're not, in fact, trained as chaplains and clergy. And it's also inappropriate to proselytize. Respect and dignity of the other person is paramount in this work.
How does this work at a very practical level? Mm-hmm. How do you go about beginning to engage with a patient at this level of faith and spirituality?
So we developed a tool called FICA, a spiritual history tool. And physicians and other clinicians who develop treatment plans generally do a history, a clinical history. And in that history, we ask about why you're here. What is your past medical history? What is your social history? We call the patient-centered or person-centered part of the interview. And that's where we ask about relationships and work and avocations. And that's where we've put in the spiritual history. And so the tool is simply, do you have spiritual beliefs or practices that are important in your life? What gives your life meaning? And then looking at how is that important and what influence, the I part of that, what influence does that have in the way that you understand health and illness and make healthcare decisions. So it's very much law. It's not just out there, but it's lodged and related to what the person is going through. So obviously, if someone is dying, how is this in your life now that you're dying? If it's a well visit, how does your spirituality impact your understanding of health? So it's across all terms. And then C is community, which could be church, temple, mosque, but might be like-minded friends. And then A is how should that be addressed in your care? Now that we've developed models, we actually propose, and this is a bit controversial, but you know, we propose that clinicians think about a rule-out diagnosis, that if I think there's spiritual distress in the patient, I'm going to look at what is that distress? Is it despair? Is it hopelessness? Is it isolation from their faith community or other spiritual community? But I wouldn't be the one finalizing that diagnosis. I would identify that, so that's the A part. In my plan, in my treatment plan, I would then suggest a referral to a board-certified chaplain. So the whole notion of what we call a biopsychosocial spiritual treatment assessment and treatment plan is very novel. So that we're not only looking at the physical aspects of the patient, but also at the psychosocial and spiritual aspects of the patient.
Now, as you rightly say, you're working closely, I imagine, with ministers of religion from all the different religions, not just chaplains, as you say, or people from the Catholic or Christian backgrounds.
So let's talk about that, because board-certified chaplains are not just Catholic. Chaplains come from all different religious traditions. Imams from the Muslim tradition, there are board-certified imams who are chaplains. And chaplains are a little bit different than clergy. Certainly in the Catholic tradition in the U.S., most of the chaplains are women. So that's a broader term. So yes, we work with chaplains who in turn are trained to work with people of all faiths or not. They work with atheists and agnostics as well and people who are secular. But yes, we also work with clergy and clergy of all different denominations, absolutely.
Father Bob Vitillo, how does this work relate to the whole area that you're interested in? You're working with Caritas on a very broad spectrum of health issues, particularly the focus on HIV/AIDS.
A number of ways. Certainly through the experience of HIV and AIDS, I think that many clinicians came to understand the need to pay attention to spirituality in reaching out to people with HIV. They were dealing with, until very recently, a deadly illness. Now it's with medication. It could be a chronic illness. But also, there were deep emotional and social issues around HIV. And many people who began to live with HIV had been alienated from their faith communities and even from their local communities and families. Yet they turned to spirituality to deal with the deeper meaning of this. So I think that was a good lesson that went beyond just HIV care, but to medical and social care in general. Then the other part of my interest is that because I do a great deal of advocacy at the United Nations and especially with the World Health Organization, in 1997, the World Health Assembly agreed that the spiritual dimension should be included in WHO's definition of health, good health. And yet the secretariat at WHO never took that action any further. So when I began to speak with Dr. Puchalski, I thought this is a good opportunity now for us to promote the inclusion of the spiritual dimension in health.
This is interesting that at a time when we talk so much about our growing secular societies, that there is this focus on spirituality in what is seen by many as a very secular area.
Well, I think from my own clinical observations and from working with colleagues around the world, that 9/11 and then the subsequent economic crisis has forced people to look inward. I think they've begun to lose faith, if you will, in materialism, as they've seen a lot of the problems with that, and have begun to look inward. And my own observation is that there's a huge rise in spirituality within both a religious and a secular context, because the whole question of, and again, people who are ill face this, what is really my value in life? You know, if I lose everything, if I lose my health, if I lose money, if I lose my home, whatever that loss is, who am I really in this? And these are profoundly spiritual questions. Religious organizations, religions offer people a language in for meaning and purpose, and a language for something that transcends the physical, that transcends the economics, that we still have inherent value and dignity even in the face of total loss, whether it's losing one's life, as in a dying process, or losing what previously gave them meaning in an economic crisis. So I think there is that global search now for something spiritual, and hence an increasing recognition in the importance of spirituality as part of life in general.
My thanks there to Dr. Christina Puchalski, Director of the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health, and to Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Caritas Confederation. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.